We will call the meeting to order right at 8:30, so let's go ahead and get started. First thing we're going to do is we're calling the regular and supplemental meetings together, and then we're going to adjourn or recess the supplemental meeting for later on. So with that, our first thing is to take a moment of silence for those folks that have passed in the last month. Just take a moment here. Okay, thank you. I also take a moment of silence. Nick Merrill here because his mother had passed away, and they're having a funeral service today, actually, in Pittsburgh. So let's just take a moment for silence for Judith Merrick. Okay, thank you. Okay. The next item of business is the approval of the minutes from our last meeting. I think you've seen those already, but does anybody have any comments or changes to that? Hearing none, could I get a motion to approve?
So moved.
Okay, thanks.
Second.
Second, Ken. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, it carries. Next on our agenda is the consent agenda, detailed consent agenda. Kelly, anything noteworthy here that you want to bring to our attention?
You might notice that some of the dates on this agenda of the specific things that happened are kind of old. There's one from 2018 and a couple from 2021. Did we have some outstanding items that I am resurrecting and trying to get them resolved? So you're going to see some kind of dated things that you know don't typically see because we're finally getting people to give us the paperwork and call us back, or they've got through the court process or whatever it happens to be. So that's why if you look at that, you'll see some dates that are older than you're used to seeing. But other than that, the items are typical.
Questions for Kelly? Again, hearing none, you get a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Move approval.
Thanks, Ken. Tina's second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any opposed? No? Okay, carries unanimously. Next is public comment. I think we have Christy. I think you signed up to make your comments for the board. Not making it retroactive for both my people. And so that hurt.
children. And these retirees are suing for more. And I've asked for just the other half that was taken away from my kids while I paid my mortgage. So I'm not a threat to the funding of the pension. I'm just asking for help. So that's really it. Thank you for giving me time to speak to you. And please just consider, I understand the business. I really do, but you're the business of lives too. And I'm one of those.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
We'll check that out.
Thank you.
Anybody else, John?
They're on the phone at the first five star.
No one else has wants to come. Again, thank you, Christy, for coming and we'll talk about it. Okay, our next item is a risk insurance update. Brenda and Kelly, I think, are going to lead us in that discussion.
Yes. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. This next item on the agenda is our risk insurance renewal. With us here today from our broker, A.J. Gallagher, is Eva Gideon, and on the phone also is James Martinez, who is a fiduciary specialist. As we've previously talked about, risk insurance is the second largest administrative expense for the pension. Our current policies will expire at the end of February. And if you recall, during the October board meeting, we had an item where we talked about the fiduciary insurance, specifically our policies, claim types, the expenses, and at that time the board had expressed the desire to reduce our current limit from the current $50 million limit. And let me... John, can you make that a little bigger? Is there a way to do that? This is the chart that we looked at that time, which showed that DPFP had $50 million in coverage and compared our coverage level with other public pensions. Thank you. So there's DPFP at the top at $50 million. The next group is from the state of Texas. You'll see DPFP with the asterisks on the side, and then at the bottom is just other public pensions. We are definitely an outlier at the $50 million mark, and especially if you look at other pensions comparing their asset size and their plan participation, or their plan participants. So
there's one other one at $50 million with the three asterisks with it. What is the
asterisk? So everyone with the asterisk is DPSP. It just shows.
Okay, so that's us.
Right. That is us. We just kind of wanted to highlight where were we in the group. So the bottom section is across the United States. The middle section where you see the asterisks again, those are all Texas plans. See on the left-hand side, just Texas. There's where we are in the Texas plan. And then just the very top was just DPSP.
And there is an error, which makes it a little confusing. For us, they're only listing us as 5,000 plan participants when we have 10, but that doesn't really change the story at all.
Okay, great, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, John, can we go back? See, can I take it back to just the page that, about three pages back for fiduciary, one more right there. Maybe just a little bit bigger if we could. This is our current renewal offering for 2023-2024. At this point, based on the board's previous feedback, staff is recommending that we renew only the primary and the first layer, or the first excess layer, which would give us $25 million in limit. And it would represent a cost savings to the system in 2023 of $173,000.
So we'll be going from $50 million to $25 million under this proposal?
Correct. And even at $25 million, you know, we're kind of jumping back and forth to that chart, $25 million still puts us at the top end comparing us to other Texas plans and other plans across the nation.
Because I remember the last time we talked about this, we were unusually high at
yes.
$50 million.
But I also think that reflected the time of the full litigation that was going on before and past. And now that that's dissipated tremendously, I mean, it should reflect on the insurance.
You're 100% right, Tina. I mean, we had a lot of litigation going on in the board. They needed that coverage at that time, but a lot of that has gone by the side.
Well, we also had the $50 million coverage level predates me and the litigation, and Eva probably knows, or James probably knows when we got to that level, but we've always been an outlier, and I think what we learned during the litigation is that this type of policy is really only going to cover legal expenses, and I have asked James and Eva, as well as other brokers, give me an example of something other than litigation costs where this could come into play, and haven't found an example. James, do you still agree with that? And Eva, do you still agree that it's likely this policy will cover, for our situation, primarily litigation expenses?
And I'll let James comment. He's on the line. He's our fiduciary specialist.
I just want to make one comment. I mean, in light of everything and still being an outlier, should we even consider additional cut is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it almost makes sense that we shouldn't be an outlier anymore. We should, for the size of this plan, fall into the average.
So I think the answer is yes from, I don't want to speak for Kelly or Brenda, but I think we believe the answer is yes for a couple reasons. One, the policy, the $15 million policy, and James and Eva, correct me if I'm wrong, the current policy is covered under the 2014 or 2015 policy. The claims that are currently in existence through the current litigation is covered. So this $15 million would cover us going forward under any new claim. So that's a whole new $15 million of coverage for litigation losses. Litigation's been expensive over the years. It's only been, I say only, that's been covered. I don't remember what's been used up now, $3, $4, or $5 million, something along those lines. So it's a lot of litigation that you have to engage in. And I think if you look back at that chart, $15 million puts us probably still more over the middle, but like towards the middle. And I think that's, from my perspective, I think that is more than adequate coverage for any claims that would arise. And so I think that makes sense from the system's perspective. I think we've just been respectful of the board's prior positions and prior hesitancy, and so I think we've tried to be cautious, but and I'll let Kelly give her opinion, but I think it would be appropriate. I mean, I don't think it would be inappropriate for us to get to just keep that just the primary level of $15 million and nothing else.
I agree.
I would say, given some of the people that are on the board, is protecting them, going gradually there as we sort of continue down the path, maybe make more sense than going right to only the primary coverage at this time. You know, we can revisit it again. This comes up every year, basically. If we still see what lack of litigation, at this point, I would be in favor of.
I just have confidence that most of the members on the trustee are good actors, and the aside from all of that, that are acting in a way that makes me very comfortable to consider a cut. I mean, to your point, we really test the boundaries of litigation in the last 7 years, and I don't think we really maxed out what we even have as a cut. So, but it's in the right direction. How about that?
Yeah, I clearly think going back, in my opinion, going from 50 to 25 is a big cut. And then we can go back and evaluate whether or not we should go to 15 again in another year or two, if nothing else is popping up. I would endorse staff's original recommendation.
And the only thing I'll say to that is that, just going from 50 to 25 is a big cut, but doesn't necessarily negate the fact that it really should have been like that, that it should be done all at once and not a gradual way. Considering that, I mean, again, I think it's a lot.
Kelly, were you going to add anything? Or?
I believe that $15 million is actually probably more coverage than we need, but I do respect that we got this new board in 2017, and I think it was their second meeting where that came in and said, hey, you don't know anything about us other than we have a lot of problems, let me cut your insurance. And
yes, exactly.
And we have come a long way since then, and the trustees are volunteering their time and need to feel comfortable. I think going to $25 million would be a big win. Going to 15, I think is, you know, probably the right level, but I would love to cut it down to some level. I'm very happy.
So there's no way to split the baby and do it at 20?
I mean,
that's a question really more for you guys. Is 20 or can you get that coverage?
I mean, what about
that coverage of $5 million?
Yeah. We can look at it. If 20 is the limit you would like to have, then we will go back to the first excess and ask them to provide a $5 million excess of $15 million instead of $10 million excess of $15 million. And if they're not willing to do it, we'll go to other carriers and markets.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Tina. And as I said before, with as much transparency that we have now, IAC, with the membership that we have on the IAC as well as the board, I know dumb mistakes aren't covered, but I just don't see the need for it that high.
Especially because we've done so much work pertaining to governance and
control.
The mayoral appointee, I mean, again, some of those folks have high net worth. We may not be able to keep people if they're at risk of losing some of their own personal
money. And if that's a different conversation, right? So
that's part of it. I mean, how much insurance do we need to make sure that somebody doesn't have to go into their own box if there was to be something going on?
And I agree. We've changed a lot. We fixed a lot. I have complete faith in all of our trustees. But people can sue you for anything.
So then let's just consider the $20 million. That's a good compromise, I think.
I agree.
Okay. I think that's fine.
Yeah.
Do we need something to approve today, though, or what's
I think the minutes will just reflect that there's a board direction to establish the fiduciary at the $20 million level. Because this is all done through the budgeting process, but we just the minutes will.
Wait, I thought it was 25.
We're talking about whether we want to be a 25 or 15, and the suggestion was that we split the baby and go get $20 million of coverage instead of instead of the 25.
Right. So I'm comfortable at the 25.
Nancy's comfortable at 25.
Are you not comfortable at 20?
I think it's a big jump from 50. 15 was mentioned, but I thought from previous conversations that it was around the 25. I'm just comfortable at the 25.
Well, I'm sorry. What was her issue?
I'm fine with the 29.
25. Doesn't want to go down to 20.
Well, the reason why she doesn't want to go is because initially it was at 50, so she goes from 50 to 25 is a drastic jump down.
That was my
going to 20 is too big of a jump, is what she's saying. Somebody else said something. Who else is on there?
This is Steve Ido. I'm fine with the 20 million. It's fine with me.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Mark.
This is Michael Brown. I would prefer the 25 million. Although I'd prefer the 25.
What is our timing of having to commit to these things? I mean, can we get the pricing on the 20 and the 25 and bring it back next month, or no? We've got to move.
Well, we can bind. Can we bind at 25 and then lower it?
No.
No. Okay.
Because we would have to. Yeah, we would have to restructure that second excess. We can lower it next year, but once you bind. Midterm, it would be counterproductive to try to negotiate.
Right.
I think we've got three to four people who want to keep it at 25, and others are okay with 20, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I think at this point, I would say there should be a, I think rather than a direction, I think you guys should probably do a formal motion to direct the staff and see what the people take a vote of the board.
Okay. Who wants to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we look at $20 million. Second.
Okay, that's Marcus made that motion. Ken second that motion. All in favor of going to finding it $20 million instead of $25 million? I give it on the phone.
Aye. I would like to go on the record also at 25. I do not. I'm a nay.
Michael, you were at 25 yes. as well?
Yes, I'm at okay. 25 as well.
And who else is on the Steve?
This is Steve Ido. I'm fine with the 20.
Okay. And then Mark, are you on?
No, he's not. Armando.
I'm fine with the 20.
Okay, so we will directly go to 20, but reflect that the vote, I guess it was 6-4 or
6-3.
6-3, yeah. No, it was Nancy.
Nancy, Bill,
Michael.
And Mike.
Okay. Michael. Wow, it's the first time we haven't had a unanimous vote.
In a long, long time.
In a long time. Yeah. Your president.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's continue with the presentation then on the other insurance.
Well, I think that was the hard part. The rest of it will be easier as we move along. The next insurance is cyber insurance. And, John, if you could try again to make that a little bit bigger, I'll keep that in mind. If you'll recall, last year the cyber insurance market was very hard. Our premiums skyrocketed, our offerings were reduced, and the insurance requirements just to get insurance were very lengthy. So during this past year, John has spent the year working with our insurance company, working with our vendors, and we've implemented several additional security protocols. So thank you, John, for all your hard work this past year. The result of that hard work, I'm happy to report, is we were offered our primary cyber layer at $69,000, which represents a $46,000 decrease in premium. So we're very excited. This was the good news in our renewal. We were also offered a first excess of an additional $5 million, which would give us $10 million in coverage for an additional $51,000. We spent some time talking with Gallagher, trying to determine what is the appropriate level, 5 or 10. They provided some information about average incident costs, which for small or medium enterprises turns out to be about $170,000. Large corporations, it was more like $15 million. They also provided some information on what type of organizations are most likely to experience cyber losses. And in looking at that chart, if you put us in with government entities, that's about 4% of government entities. If you say we're a financial organization, about 8% of financial organizations. So we're on kind of the lower end of organizations that might experience a cyber loss. After looking at that information and talking with Gallagher and internally, we believe that we would be sufficiently covered with just a primary cyber layer at the $69,000. But we wanted to open that up since we had had additional layers in the past and see if the board had any recommendations on whether they would like to pursue an additional cyber layer.
Can you just go again, why you think getting rid of that amount makes sense?
So we don't currently have, right now we only have a primary layer at $5 million. Last year we were not offered anything beyond a primary layer. So this year we are being offered an excess layer. Looking at the information that Gallagher provided on incident costs for small and medium enterprises, so it doesn't fit us exactly, so we're trying to take the information and extrapolate from there. Small and medium enterprises, the average incident cost was $170,000.
So yeah, I think the basis of the recommendation is if we had to make a claim, it would more likely be under $5 million than between $5 million and $10 million. If it's a ransomware thing, it's going to be, you know, way more than the $10 million. So that's why we said, well, that $10 million, that $5 to $10 million, we may not get there. But a ransomware type thing could get into that layer. Eva, do you have anything that might help the board think about this? This is a hard one for us.
Yeah, it's a very tough one because there's a wide range of incident costs. The frequency from kind of what we see most often tends to be in the $200,000 range. I have had personally two of my large clients have had a ransomware attack, and one ended up being at over $10 million. The other one was at $5 million, which was their limit, so it worked out. But
could I ask what type of businesses those two businesses were?
Yeah, they were commercial manufacturing and distribution.
Okay.
Yeah. So from a type of business and type of operation standpoint, they're quite different. However, you're also very different from the standpoint of the fact that you have a lot of personal information. So to that end, you may be more of a target than just a manufacturer of widgets. So there's kind of obviously arguments to be made on both sides.
So just to be clear, the additional like level is just a matter of like money and coverage. It's not like extra bells and whistles or additional services.
No, we don't get any more limits on the type of, you know, the little subtypes of the claims. It's just, it covers more and costs more.
So one point I should make from a legal perspective is Eva's point about the personal information. As a governmental entity, the system enjoys, not the right word, but is afforded, you know, certain immunities from suit. And so unlike like a big, you know, a Target or something where they have a leak and they get sued because people's personal information gets out. You know, the system does, you know, we do a good job of protecting information, but obviously no system is perfect. I think there's a good likelihood that, I mean, the lawsuit would come from the members because that's their personal information that had gotten out. And I think the system likely would have governmental immunity, you know, from those kinds of suits. So I don't think your exposure for people's personal information from a lawsuit from the members is really that exposure. It's more either from the ransomware side of the world of where you're going to shut your operations down, or just the costs of dealing with this type of attack and how you try to repair it and do stuff like that. And the insurance clearly covers those types of covers the cost. Ransomware, as we talked about, may or may not. But I don't think from the system's perspective, the personal information getting out is not, I don't think, should be a huge concern given the immunity defense that the system would have, like any other governmental entity in Texas would have. So I just want the board to understand that.
Did I hear, Eva, you said in your two cases, the one that had $5 million coverage settled because that's all the coverage was there, versus the other one had bigger coverage, therefore they went after a bigger amount of money?
They didn't. None of the cases actually paid the ransomware, and we do have clients around the country that have chosen to pay the ransomware to put an end to the attack. But in these two cases, they didn't actually pay the ransom. They fought it. They worked with IT and forensics and the legal team to restore their systems and repair really the damage that had been done internally.
And does this coverage cover those costs?
It does.
So it covers the cost of doing some of that.
Of hiring consultants, IT specialists, forensics, doing the restoration to their systems, and certainly a legal aspect if that is part of the claim. But I agree with the comments that really your biggest exposure from a severity perspective, where it can get into the millions, is from a ransomware attack.
What do we think, John, it would cost us to hire these experts and recover without paying the ransomware?
I would rely on the insurance people to pay those fees. I've never done anything like that.
It really varies. It varies based on the extent of the damage and the type of malware
and
that may be.
How many pensions have
been attacked?
Huh?
How many pensions have been
I know
attacked?
Of one
really?
Here in Texas.
Okay.
And it was a few years ago. It wasn't ransomware. They
but
had another issue. And they ended up dealing with it themselves. This is when our cyber insurance was like $5,000. I'm like, why didn't you have cyber insurance? And they spent, I think he told me, they spent about $300,000 because they had to buy credit monitoring service for all their members and, you know, do IT stuff because it was the personal information got out. So I know of that one.
But as far as ransomware, you don't know of a pension that has experienced that?
I don't. But governments are a big target.
Target, yes. What does staff recommend?
We recommended going to the lower level because of the governmental immunity. But I could support either, really, because I think a ransomware issue, if we had to pay it, I don't know why we would have to pay it because we have – we can get our pension payroll out even with a ransomware attack because of our secondary, our disaster recovery piece, I believe. It's basically $5,000 more. Is it more or less?
Right. So if we
to
purchase
go to 10,
both the 69 and the 51, that would be a total of $120,000. And this past year we paid $115,000, so you'd be paying about $5,000 additional for having $10 million in coverage.
In 2023 that we paid in
right.
2022.
Just because our 2022 premiums were so, that was such a difficult renewal period, now we'll be able to double the coverage for essentially $5,000 more than we paid last year, or we could save $46,000. By only going with one layer.
So I have a question. Do you make yourself a target by having such a high bar of insurance? You know, is this public information?
You know,
like,
do you
know?
It's a
public meeting now, so it's yes,
yeah.
That was really what my
you know,
question was,
if,
by having a higher coverage.
Yeah, user. If you're going to kidnap somebody, kidnap the rich kid, and the rich kid, you know, whose parents are very rich.
Because they don't ever have to go beyond what's insurance.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Never even thought about that.
Well, staff was recommending just the primary coverage and having the savings. Does anybody have an issue with that? I think that makes some sense.
Yeah, I agree.
I like it.
Okay. Nobody has a concern. Why don't we go with the primary?
Okay.
We got at least one more to cover here.
We have one more. Very small. The crime, the reason I'm singling out the crime, when normally I would just roll it in with all other, is the retention on the crime this year went from $25,000 to $35,000. And so I wanted to point that out. There is a premium change. We had higher assets and some other issues that have led to the additional premium change. So crime at $35,000 retention. We were also offered a crime policy with a $50,000 retention, which would save us, you know, $2,000.
Brenda, explain to me what this is.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Please explain to me what this covers.
So crime would be if our employee committed a crime within the organization.
So it would be embezzlement, I guess. They're embezzling funds from the entity.
So, I mean, there's a list of sub-coverages, and I don't know if you want to go into
it. Would this cover the loss, or is this covering just the litigation around it?
So,
I mean, I don't even understand, like, even in an embezzlement situation, what this would do.
Eva, would you like to?
Yeah, it would actually cover the loss. So if an employee embezzled from the system or from the retiree, this is the policy that would respond, subject to the circumstances around the incident.
So the crime covers some other things, too.
Right. So employee theft, computer fraud, funds transfer fraud, social engineering. So all of those, social engineering is where you think you're getting an email from someone, like in the, Kelly sends an email that says, please transfer $5 million, and we think it's from her, so we transfer $5 million, and we find out it wasn't from her.
Okay.
So it covers those different types of crimes.
And social engineering has a sub-limit of $250,000, even though your broader policy limit is $5 million for crime, because social engineering is such a common issue that carriers really most commonly sublimited to 50 or 100,000. We've been able to get 250, but that's always going to be a lower limit than your broader crime coverage.
So our recommendation here was to it's not a lot of money. Yes, it was a big percentage increase, but dollar-wise, it's not a lot of money. So we recommended going with the lowest retention we could get, which was the 35.
I think that makes sense. You're not getting enough of a savings to pay for it.
Right.
Or you're going to have a bigger risk factor.
Right. That's exactly it. $2,000 isn't worth $15,000 in risk.
Okay.
So we'll go with the $35,000 there. The last one is just all the other insurance lines. So that's workers' comp, that's umbrella, that's property, that's auto. You can see we have a small decline in premium there.
Who do we have our workers' comp with, out of curiosity?
Chubb Insurance.
Chubb Insurance?
Thank you. So that's all for risk insurance, unless there's any questions or anything else that we can answer for the board.
Do we have all of this with Chubb then? Is this sort of a blank, so it's all with Chubb?
Quite a few of the all other policies are packaged with Chubb, so your property, general liability, auto, umbrella, and workers' comp are with Chubb.
Okay.
And you are getting the benefit of having multiple policies
right.
with one carrier.
Yeah.
But the other lines, like the cyber, or the second layer of the cyber was with, or no, the first layer is with Houston.
Yes, it's going to be with Houston, I'm sorry.
Houston casualty.
What about fiduciary insurance? Who's that with?
Fiduciary is with multiple. There's Markel, Hudson, Star. You know, each layer is with.
We're eliminating.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Second, third,
fourth. Markel, thank you. Markel is the primary layer, and currently the first excess is with
Euclid.
Okay.
Whether it will remain that way when we move from 10 to 5, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, good. We're covered with this, I think. Anything else? Any other questions anybody has on the board? If not, we'll go to the financial report, Brenda.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your time and attention on that.
Thank you, Eva. Yeah, appreciate
you. Thank you so
much. Thank you, Eva.
Thank you.
And James. Thank you, James. Thank you, everyone. I know this is not a fun and exciting topic, but certainly an important one. I'm going to start the fourth quarter financial review with the bridge chart. The bridge chart represents the changes in net position over the period by adjusting for investment, benefit, and operation-related transactions during the period to arrive at the ending net position. So we began the year with a net position of $2.18 billion. We had investment-related transactions that decreased net position of about $226 million, and benefits and operations-related transactions that decreased net position by $108 million, and our 12/31/2022 preliminary net position is $1.84 billion, down $334 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I'm briefly going to discuss some highlights from the financials. The combined statements of fiduciary net position. The first item there, this report compares the results from December 31st, 2021 to December 31st, 2022. The first section is investments. Total investment value at December 31st was $1.75 billion. That compares to $2.1 billion in the prior year, so down $351 million over the year. And this decline is primarily related to the decline in equities and fixed income over the year. As we move down the page, we see cash and cash equivalents. It has increased about $15 million since the last year end. At the bottom of the page, you'll see accounts payable and other accrued liabilities. It has declined by $1.4 million over the year, and that's primarily related to the payment of expenses since last year end. As we move on to the combined statements of changes in fiduciary net position, this again, since it's year end, is comparing December over December, the 12 months there. City and member contributions increased by $6.2 million when compared to last year. City contributions increased by almost $5.1 million year over year, and that increase is primarily related to the increase in the floor. The floor increase for the past year was $4.2 million. So most of that increase for the city is related to the floor. Overall, member contributions increased by $1.2 million, and that's due to increased employee salaries. Employee headcount is probably down about 30 when compared to last year. As we move down the page and we look at net investment income, the change in net investment income was $549,000. There was a $549 million, excuse me. I wish it was only thousands. We had a $226 million loss in 2022, and that compares to a $323 million gain in the prior year. As we continue to move down the page and we look at benefits paid to members, benefits, they have increased by $7.9 million over the prior year, and new service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase paid to members. Are there any questions about the financials?
We've pretty much seen that with before, nothing new. Okay, great. Okay, our next item is the board approval of education and travel. Kelly?
Right. On page 24, you could just flip it and then get that back to Ryan.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh.
Because he's after me. On 24 and 25 in your PDF are the six classes that Carol has listed that are TEXPERS and NCPERS classes. You're welcome to attend any of these. Just the board needs to approve your attendance.
Yes. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If I go to these experts, does that account for some of the education?
Yes, it does.
So, okay.
You have to take that all over again now as a new
person? That's what I'm wondering. Like, and if that should be the case, that's exactly what I'm going at, Bill. I will attend the Tech First.
Okay, perfect. Okay. And that is in Austin in April. Is there anybody else that would like to be added?
So I think if Melissa can verify, would that remedy my issue?
No, I think you guys did from the beginning. I don't think it does. Okay, I think
that's a good question. So Carol knows the answer, your answer, Tina. She's already checked.
Okay.
You don't have to do the core over, but you have to continue.
Thank the Lord. Okay.
Marcus, what was your question? If you've taken classes there, can you do that?
I've been talking to Carol about various different courses I have to take.
Mm-hmm.
With this remedy that are, they're separate.
Yes, this would cover what you need to take, your core classes. You need to make sure you're attending the sessions in the right order and you get them signed off on.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't cover your open meeting, open records training that you have.
Okay, like the governance. The governance.
Yeah.
Okay.
You
still
have to do that. But
yeah, because I'm on another board.
But I'm okay with that.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
So if anybody wants to attend or thinks they might want to attend, we can add them to the list. Definitely have Tina, and we'll need a motion for that. Anybody else?
Motion.
A second.
Yeah. This is for the, which one?
Tech.
Okay, we got a motion to approve.
Yes, thank you.
Tina attending. Anybody oppose that? Okay, it's approved.
Okay. And by the way, you're not limited to just the classes we put on here. Each trustee has a budget, and if you have something else you want to attend, just let us know.
Like some of the CFA stuff might work. Too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
The budget's what, like $5,000 or so?
Per
trustee?
Yeah, per year.
Yeah, the maximum is $5,000.
Maximum is $5,000. We budgeted the maximum.
We budgeted because we've had multiple years where there has been little to no. We budgeted about $35,000. So that was enough for half the board to go and do that because we just not experienced that, but we could always do a budget amendment if we needed additional dollars.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
We are now on to Ryan.
Mike, can I come up?
Sure.
All right. Just want to point, I'm going back to the bridge chart that was in Brenda's financials, and just occurred to me looking at the 107 or 108 million going out to pay benefit payments. We have $109 million in distributions coming in from the private portfolio. So, talked about that number before, but it's almost exactly what we had to pay out net.
Which number are you referring to?
The 107, like the $9 million, $9 to $10 million a month in net outflows for benefit payments. We had 109 coming back in from the private market. So we redeployed some of that, but, you know, we had enough coming from the private portfolio to cover all the benefit outflows last year. So I'm going to point that out. All right, I'll move ahead to the portfolio update. We are on page 28 here. So that being said, we have not received a whole lot of private market distributions year to date. We do have a $16 million distribution expected from an AEW property sale that should close a week from tomorrow. Reminder that we're in the drawdown mode on the safety reserve. We went to flip that switch on in March of 2022. I'll talk about the consultant search and the subcommittee on the next page, but we expect the RFP to be issued next week. On rebalancing, we haven't done a whole lot since November. With that $16 million that we expect to come back, we have another $9 million that we haven't redeployed, so we'll probably look at what to do with that those amounts later on in February, come back with a recommendation. So year-to-date, it's the first month of the year, but it's nice to have some charts and arrows going in the right direction this time, so we're up 4.2% on the overall portfolio and 6.4% on the public markets portion of it. So on the consultant search, subcommittee met a week ago Monday on the 30th to go through process planning, RFP, evaluation criteria, just to talk about process. So we are narrowing down our final list of firms that we want to go out to. It'll be invitation only. I sent out those firms on the blackout list email yesterday. We hope to issue the RFP sometime next week. And then we would give all the firms about a month to respond to it. Looking at this timeline, we'd expect to be able to get through kind of our evaluation, interviews, more subcommittee meetings, and have a recommendation back to the board towards the end of Q2 in either May or June. But I wanted to check in with the subcommittee members here to see if you guys had anything to add.
No, I think that, well, yes.
You're not official yet, Tina. So.
it's actually starting off with a good start. I mean, it's much more collaborative about picking consultants and investment advisors, more than just from staff. I think a couple of trustees have kind of grown names in the hat. That's been really good. And that was a little bit different than before. With that said, there's more people that are less. It seems like more consultants or investment advisors that are not so, like, the risk issues when we initially looked at consultants and investment advisors seemed to be very high, but it seems like now people are coming to the table and looking at, you know, advisory services a little bit more seriously.
Do you have any minority firms on the RFP list?
That's a great question.
I don't believe so, but we haven't checked that.
But I will tell you, though,
yeah.
From the original, it was one of our forefront was, if I recall correctly, was Nikita and was Varys. Those were the two front leading as far as, like, at least composition of internal members in a diverse way. That it was at one point. If that's the same way now, I don't know that would be the case, but I do remember from the original that was.
Wait, repeat. Can you repeat that? Can you repeat what you just said, Tina?
So two of the names that were on the original when Gilbert and I were on, and this was diversity was a consideration in looking at the investment consultants. I think the two entities were Makita,
Varys.
And they are on the list again this time.
And there are questions in the RFP about their diversity and their ownership as well as.
Yeah. And I mean, most of these firms, you know, at least on the general consulting side, are bigger partnerships where there's a lot of ownership within, you know, the partners at the firm. So I don't know how consolidated ownership is within any of them. So we'll ask more about it, you know, not just ownership, but.
Right. And I think that was a discussion last time as far as the ownership of an entity, but also the composition of the consultant.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right. Who we're actually working with. That should also be taken into account. I'm particularly sensitive to that because I compete all the time for business, and one of the most frustrating parts of you know, the selection process is a lot of times these public entities don't look at the composition of the actual people who are responsible for the account. They look at other things, but they don't ever see the actual composition of the people who are dealing with the account on a day-to-day basis. So I just want to, you know, highlight that that really should also be a part of the questionnaire.
Okay, we'll make sure that. There's
only one other comment that I just want to make because I think there's clarification that when we were looking at these consultants, were you looking at them as an advisory role for the illiquid private or an overall?
We're letting the proposers choose if they're bidding on everything, just the public or just the private. So
it's they're either going to come all at once or just as an advisory for the
I think in our staff limitations, but at least my bias would be to have somebody who could do both for us and deal with the same firm rather than having two different firms and splitting our time with those different firms. But
and of the groups that we plan to go out to, about half of them are general consultants that can kind of do everything, and the other half are private market specialists. So we'll kind of be able to compare.
Because Western Muni has the conventional and alternatives. I think it's Wilshire and Cliffwater.
Uh-huh.
Is that what we're speaking about?
Yeah, I don't know what happened with Cliffwater. I think Axia.
Cliffwater definitely does the alternatives.
Yeah, I think Axia, who's one of the firms that. Google that real quick. I think they acquired Cliffwater a couple of years ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
And
okay.
They're one of the private market specialty firms that we're talking to.
Yeah, but they have like two different consultants.
Yeah, yeah. So.
It was Tory Cove.
Okay. So, but yeah, we have a mix of specialty private markets groups and then general consultants that do everything to talk to.
So that's a good start.
Good.
All right, moving forward here. On page 30 now, looking at the equity market drawdown. We're going back to the beginning of 22 on this. you know, obviously the markets have recovered quite a bit the last month and a half or so. One thing that's interesting, if you look at the level of drawdown of the ACWI IMI, which is our primary equity benchmark, it is down almost exactly the same percentage as it was when we put the safety reserve in the drawdown mode in March of 22. So it's gone down, you know, it's down 25%, it's back to that level. So I think, you know, if the markets keep going up, a discussion to be had, you know, internally with you guys is when to go out of drawdown mode on the safety reserve and when do you start refilling the short-term core bonds and doing something different with the cash that's coming back. So I think kind of depending on where markets are, we'll have that discussion with the money that, that we have to redeploy potentially in the next month or so and figure out, you know, what the right level to say we're out of it and we want to rebuild the safety reserve is. Moving on, same chart we've been showing, but this is showing peak inter-year declines in S&P 500 and what we ended up last year. Maximum drawdown was 25, S&P ended up down 19. So we'll track that through this year. So Mike is up here. He's listened to every Jerome Powell press conference in the last year. So I figured he'd be the best person to give you guys an update on just you both have a great expectation, you know, what the yield curve looks like. And yeah. I'll be Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all well aware that rates have been going up. It's partially that in our personal lives. But this kind of just puts it in perspective as in how fast they've gone up. And relative in the historical standpoint that the last time they were this high were pre-GFC. You know, the yield curve is currently inverted. We're higher on the short-term rates, lower long-term. Really, it's take it for what it's worth because these are projections, and I think last year at this time, nobody projected we would be where we are today. But projections are that there will be rate cuts sometime either latter this year, in the latter part of this year or next year. You can see on the right part of the chart, you have the Fed's estimates for rates going forward and then the market expectations. Fed is in dark blue, market is in teal. They differ quite a bit with the market thinking rates will be cut sooner than the Fed has projected. How that plays out, I guess we'll see based off of inflation and slowing economic growth. And then you also have, you know, some economic forecasts there in that box above, but not going to dig too much into that because we can see from last year how forecasts were not very spot on.
And this chart comes from a JP Morgan deck they do. They update it daily, actually. And the green line with market expectations and then the Fed estimates, like as we're getting closer to the terminal rate, that converged quite a bit, even over the week between when we initially printed this and we updated it. So, all right. Thanks, Mike. Skip ahead to the bridge chart. I should say that the total portfolio is up 4.2%. Year-to-date at the top, you know, the $11 million in benefit outflows in January and the $76 million in investment gain within just January, which led us to a NAV at $1.89 billion at the end of January.
We're going in the right direction now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One out of 12 months, good start. So this is a board request at the last meeting to extend out kind of the public performance to the 5-year just to see how the public part of the portfolio is compared to the 60-40. So these are returns as of end of December, and it just the new information is the 5-year at 4.9% up compared to the 60-40 at 4.7.
This is a really good chart. I mean, it shows that we actually have done a good job with what we can control. And we're still sort of hamstrung with the private investments, our legacy investments. But we're doing, you know, a decent job, and especially the one-year number where we protect it on the downside somewhat. So kudos to the investment team.
Thanks, Bill. Looking at this is as of end of January, the public market performance snapshot. A few things to point out on here, similar kind of trend where our portfolio is outperforming the 60-40. Up 6.4% in January compared to 5.7. Invesco, the growth equity manager, was up 10.3 compared to the benchmark at 7.2. So they're, as expected, with them kind of recapturing a little bit on the upside. That's nice to see. And then RBC, our EM equity manager, was up 10.2 compared to the benchmark at 7.6. And they've really performed well over the last 18 months, and it, you can see it in the three-year number as well, where they're outperforming by 1.5% compared to the benchmark. And then on the three-year, you know, even though Invesco has had their struggles, you can see kind of the four active managers there at the top, Boston Partners, Manulife, Invesco, and Walter Scott. You know, a few of them are right at benchmark. Boston Partners, the value managers, outperforming by 4.1%. And then, you know, overall, those four are outperforming over, you know, the trailing 3 years. And then I saw a stat that for a 60-40 portfolio, this was the top 2% month of all time for the return of a 60-40, both equities being up quite a bit and the bonds performing well. The safety reserve, we're at $118 million at the end of January, and it with $63 million of that being in cash and $55 million in the short-term core bond portfolio with IRM. Based on the current projected net outflows for benefit payments of $9.6 million a month, we have enough to cover through January of 24, so another year of coverage within that portfolio. Bottom right, looking at the cash balance, 63 right now, depending on what we do with the proceeds coming up here. We shouldn't need to pull any more cash over, everything else being equal, till kind of end of April timeframe.
Where is the $63 million invested now?
It's IRM, the short-term core bond.
So it's in the short-term one.
The 63 is in cash.
What is money market fund?
It's a money market fund.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of bank accounts cash that are yielding nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
money market funds are now in the 4 or 5 range.
OGAS.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's in the money market fund. It, I think it's yielding right around 4.
Four and a half.
Yeah, so we're not, it's not stale. It's earnings on that cash.
Just wanted to make sure we're not leaving it in a bank account.
4.28 right now.
Okay, that's good.
No. All right. So this is the asset allocation detail in global equity. If we do redeploy more into public equity, we've been filling up the two small cap bond, or small cap equity managers over the last year. We probably look at this kind of shaded bar showing percent of target. Since we're underweight everywhere, we're trying to show pro rata how much we're underweight. We probably look to add to the passive product with the next slug of money coming back in. Looking at the forward calendar, we'll start next month going through, working through the portfolio with a presentation from Clarion on their real estate portfolio, and then AEW will be coming in April. Any questions on the portfolio?
It's good.
All right.
Off to a good start now.
Yeah.
We've got to sustain that.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, so we have an item here on some subcommittee and IAC appointments. So the first item A here, we set up the subcommittee to help out with consultant search last month. There's currently 5 members on it. I talked to Tina kind of in between or after the last board meeting. She served on the subcommittee for the 2018 consultant search, so her experience there is going to be very valuable. But so we want to have the board appoint her, add her to the subcommittee at this meeting. She was on the call last week too, so we'll formally appoint her. Any discussion on that item before I move on to the IAC?
No.
Okay.
We'll just take a motion.
Yeah, we'll do it all.
Yeah, let's do them both together.
Okay, so the next item, so a reminder on the IAC, we need to have a majority of outside members, non-board members on the committee. Right now there's 4 board members on and 4 outside members, so we needed to add additional outside members to the IAC to have that quorum. And then another issue we've had at some meetings where one outside member can't attend and all the board members typically do attend, then we don't have an official meeting if we don't have at least more outside people. So over the last month, we've identified two quality candidates that are willing. I've talked to both of them to come on to the IAC to serve two-year terms, or we'd appoint them initially for two-year terms. We provided the resumes of each of them in the closed session portion of the agenda. But like I said, I've talked to both of them, and I think they'll be great additions to the committee. And then we also wanted to extend formally the or reappoint and extend the term of Michael Kinhaven and Bob Jones on the IAC.
I would just add that I guess Jameel McNeil, who's one of them with Tina, knows well and has recommended, so we feel comfortable. And then Nick had recommended Luke Gittemeyer, who he knew well. So, I mean, they both come well vetted and recommended by board members.
So if we can, if anybody has questions or concerns or wants more information about them, we could go into closed session if you're, you know, if you don't need that, we don't need to go into closed session.
So has the staff met with the people that are being recommended?
I've had phone, like, half-hour phone calls with both of them, and, you know, they had good questions. And I really try to set the expectations for, like, what the IAC works on, what the time commitment would be, how the meetings go, what their focus is versus the board. So I think they know what they're getting into, and they want to do it. So
there's no conflict of interest.
I don't see a reason to go to closed session unless anybody has a...
Yeah, we would try to, just like we did with all you guys when you came on, have them in to meet the full staff and do an orientation before.
Right.
Their first meeting would be the March 25th, I think it's right, David. End of March, IAC meeting would be their first actual meeting of the committee.
Okay, there's no problem. I'll move that we appoint Tina to the subcommittee, and we recommend, we'll appoint Jameel McNeil and Luke Gittemeyer as outside investment professionals with terms ending 12/31/24, and extending the terms of Robert Jones, Ken Haven, and Michael Brown as well. So, second. Thanks, Tony. Okay. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none. It's unanimous. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, the investment policy statement.
All right, so the IPS item.
Something we've been waiting for.
Yeah, get it done, and we'll make some more changes to that this month. So this was a diverse manager item. We talked about it last month, where on a public search, we would seek to include one firm that has at least 50% ownership from a diverse group. I'll go to the actual language. Last month, we also had a size component of four under $2 billion. Based on the discussion at the January board meeting, we decided to drop that off and simplify it to actually be what we're trying to target here with, you know, for inclusion in the RFP process. So it is on Section 7 of the IPS, which is... page 58 of Diligent. So there's two sections of the policy, but... And this matches what we've done in the last four public searches, not by policy, just by what... You know, how it shook out, but we would seek an RFP on a public manager search from at least one manager that has majority 50% or more economic ownership from either female, veteran, disabled, or non-white ownership.
Okay.
Any discussion or?
If not, we need a motion to approve the revised policy.
So moved.
Ken, thank you.
Second.
Second, Marcus. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Yeah, that was a four. Nancy was up four. Any opposed? No. Hearing none, it's approved. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, real exciting stuff. The employee handbook.
And I'm going to go over every page. No, I'm not going to go over every page. The handbook starts on page 67 and goes to page 131 of your material, so I'm not going to go over every page. This handbook was approved in full by the board in June of 2022, and we told you that we'd be making changes and adding in the IT policies as an exhibit at a later date. So today what I want to do is talk to you about some of the changes that are in here. I think there's about eight of them that I want to just tell you what we're doing and just briefly why, in case you looked at it and didn't understand why we were making the change. So feel free to ask me any other changes that I might skip through, but I won't take a whole lot of time because it is so interesting. So the first one I want to talk about is on page 88, and this is, of course, I can't read the page numbers. John, can you move it? I'm having a hard time reading the page numbers with my old eyes. Okay. So this section 3.3, that is just I'm changing the leave days to leave hours because we have two employees that are working nine-hour days. That's just a clarification thing.
Nine-hour days?
They're working, yeah, they work 9 hours a day. So they work 9 hours, 9 days instead of 10 days in a two-week period. So they have every other Friday off.
Oh, okay.
And this just clarified they don't get one extra hour for each of their personal days. So, and in the future, we might have other people with flexible schedules like that. So that's those are the types of cleanup items here that you'll see in here. On page 89 and 90, that was a change to sick leave. You might remember that in June we had a benefit which was attendance incentive leave, which didn't work, so we took those hours. Half of them went to personal leave and half of them went to sick leave. We wrote the formula in a way that you didn't get those extra hours in your sick leave until you've been here for a year because you weren't eligible for AIL for a year. The way we had the formula, it didn't work, so this is just fixing that formula. On page 94, we matched this policy to really the way that we've been operating, and it relates to jury duty, and it just clarifies that non-exempt employees also get paid for jury duty. That wasn't clear on the policy, but that's how we've been operating. I've also put in there that there's a compensation offset because sometimes actually jury duty does pay more than you would think. Sometimes it doesn't. It just depends. So we don't want to have them be paid by the courts and paid by us if it's some material amount. Page 96. I've amended this language related to the health savings account reimbursement. The way our policy works is employees get the system contribution in January and July, but our renewal is actually April 1. So there's a mismatch if people change from an individual plan to a family or a family and spouse. So that's just marrying up those two concepts to make sure everybody is treated equally. Let's see. The biggest change really starts here in Section 4. It's not, it's biggest in the number of pages. And what I've done is deleted the whole section on FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act. Originally, I had this in here because although you have to have more than 50 employees for FMLA to apply, it also has a provision in there that if you're a governmental entity, it applies. And the way we were previously reading that, we thought we had to be covered by it. But on further research, we now believe we aren't covered by FMLA. So I've taken out, I think, 8 pages related to FMLA and also FMLA in other places. And I can tell you that eliminating this thinking that we're not subject to FMLA doesn't do anything. FMLA hasn't helped or hurt the system in any way in the past, and it hasn't helped or hurt an employee in any way in the past that I'm ever aware of. So nobody's gaining or losing on this, in my opinion.
So we're not covered by it.
We're not covered by FMLA. On 113, this is kind of the most important thing I want to bring to your attention.
Well, let me just make a distinction there. It's a very technical legal distinction. The system may be covered by FMLA, but the employees are not because they're not a covered employee because it has to be 50 employees who are covered. So the difference is, like, we might still have to post those notices that are required by the DOL in our lunchroom, but
right,
the employees themselves are not afforded the coverage under FMLA, if you understand the distinction there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, bottom line is, they don't get the benefits of it, so we don't need to provide for it under the policy.
Okay. That's a lawyer there.
Sorry.
Section 5.22, I've added a section called Employee Handbook Modifications, and I'm introducing a concept that I would not have to bring this handbook back to you if I'm making these administrative changes. But I will need to bring it back to you if I'm making anything that changes the economic benefits for the employee or the system or the budget. So I can't add vacation or, you know, increase vacation accruals or add more holidays or those types of things that cost the system money without bringing it to you. But I can add additional IT policies or continue to make tweaks or respond to laws and things like that. So that's a new concept in here, if you agree with that. And then the last sections are the IT policies. And what we're doing, what John is doing, is working with his group of professionals and coming up with these different IT exhibits, and we'll add to this as we go. So we've got two now that are in here. The first one is the Organizational Security Charter, which really just is the framework and the principles of how the security of the IT stuff will work, and then an acceptable use technology policy, and additional ones will be added to that. And those policies follow here. And this is these policies that follow are all new in here, but nothing unusual. And those are the highlights of the handbook. Are there any other questions or more information you like? I can talk about any of it.
Okay. We need a vote. I'll move that we approve the revisions to the policy in the handbook.
I'll second.
Second. Anybody opposed?
Yes.
Okay. It carries. So you've got a revised handbook now.
Thank you. And you won't see it again unless I'm doing something that
economically impacting the system.
Right.
Okay. Next is our monthly contribution report.
Right. So this is the same report that you've seen now every month for years. And this is the February report. It still has the last December 2022 data. There's nothing unusual about this report. If there's two pay periods in this section, we're still lower than the floor and above the hiring plan. So the floor is helping us. This is the last month. The floor will help us. So starting next month, that floor amount that is in here, that goes away. So since we've had the floor in place, it has provided $48.99 million to the funds. If we would have not put that floor concept in, we would have roughly $49 million less than we have today. So that has served us well. Unfortunately, the floor going forward goes down, and so the actual contributions we get will be based on the actual comp pay.
The floor goes down or goes away?
It goes down, but basically it's not going to
impact us.
Not going to, yeah, because it's really equal to the hiring plan, which we've been exceeding. So it goes down for 2 years, and then it goes away in 2025. So that is the contribution report. What I would like to propose with this, and we'll talk to Nick about it to make sure he's okay with it, but since the information is pretty static in here, I propose putting this in the executive director's report and then just highlighting any changes every month and not have it a separate item. Is anybody opposed to that idea? Okay. Is that all right?
Yeah, I just want...
I know the look.
So I just want to make everybody aware that it's a discussion item here where you can talk about issues related to contributions. Once it gets on the executive director's report, then I will have to throw the flag if you all talk about substantive issues relating to contributions. So, I mean, I just want you to be aware that once we do that, that's what would happen. So, and then we can move it back if you feel like you want to do that, have a discussion.
Why change it then? I mean, it gives us more flexibility to ask questions. Why not leave it in?
Agreed.
And then, you know, if you can do it in a very summarized fashion when there's nothing material to report, but it gives us the opportunity to ask questions.
Also, new members, you probably might have more questions if they become more familiar with kind of discussions and the issue of the floor is becoming more and more prevalent.
Okay. All right. I will keep it as it is. I was just trying to save you a little bit
of
time.
You can probably summarize it. I mean, even the number of things you got in there, maybe you want to look at reformatting it to be a one- or two-page simple report.
Okay.
I think the most important is how many people are in the hiring plan and how many are actually on payroll.
Right.
That's, to me, is the one I look at all the time.
Okay.
Josh, legislative update?
Yeah, so until yesterday, last night, I would say there was actually no real pension bills that affected anybody. The only pension bills that have been filed up till last night were mainly bills dealing with TRS and the ARS COLAs. A bill was filed last night, HB 2068. I guess I would characterize it as an ESG bill. It's pretty complicated, and I haven't had a lot of time to look through it, and honestly, I think we'll continue to monitor it and see what happens in the process. It deals with what boards and investment managers can do and how they can take ESG into account, describe them as material factors, and it's got some interesting aspects to it, including kind of pulling in organizations that the investment manager may belong to and statements that they make as being evidence of a violation of the statute. I'm sure most, if not all of you, are aware that this is a movement around the country in different states, either through legislation or through executive action on the part of governors or attorneys general or state controllers to affect these types of things. I mean, this has obviously got political overtones, and I'm hopeful we're not going to have a discussion about that. I think from an investment perspective, we'll monitor the bill, see what happens. I'm sure, you know, Tom being the former CIO at ERS, and the state systems are in this bill as well as the local systems, and so they will have thoughts on it, whether they will say that publicly or more likely privately to legislators, I would guess. There will be conversations, and so I don't know where the bill will go, but it is. I just want the board to be aware that it was introduced and it's out there, and really we just kind of wait and see. Right now, I would say it should not affect anything that this board does in terms of investment activity, and we'll just see if the bill gets passed and put into law. You know, we'll deal with it at that point. So that's the legislation the only piece of legislation right now that's out there. In terms of the bill that Ms. Walters discussed. The bill was sent to Legislative Council. We got it back. We looked at it, and then we realized that there was one technical change, really, to make sure that children under 19 got the full benefit if both parents were deceased. So we sent it back to the Legislative Council for the fix, and Legislative Council has advised that they should be getting it back to be getting the bill back out soon, and then at that point, once we have a final version of it, we can then get it, we can find a sponsor and have it filed and get it online. We're not behind in any way. The committees will probably not start hearing bills until end of the month or beginning of next month. In fact, they just had committee appointments yesterday for the Pensions Committee. The Rafael Anchia was formerly the chairman of the committee. He's not the chairman of the committee this session. It's Giovanni, and I always mispronounce his last name. He's the representative out of, I think, Arlington or Fort Worth.
South Lake or Colleyville.
Capri Leone, you know, I don't know exactly how to pronounce his name, but anyway, he's the new chairman of the Pensions Committee. The other interesting thing of note on the Pensions Committee is one of our members, Frederick Frazier, who's a Dallas police officer and also an elected representative out of McKinney. He's on the committee as well. But we should hopefully get the bill out from Legislative Council, get it filed, and get the process going to get, a hearing and hopefully get it passed this session.
Can I make one clarification?
Sure.
Since you corrected me earlier.
Yeah.
I believe you said that if both parents were deceased, then the child is 100%. This other parent does not need to be deceased, but they can't be a qualified survivor. So in a divorce situation, if there's no other qualified survivor,
they can
still be living, but just not a qualified survivor.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I think actually that's the reason why these things are so difficult is there's just a lot of technical aspects that you draft it, you look at it, and you may realize that there's a glitch because of the statute, the way the statute reads, and so that's what happened this time is we just kind of realized we have the bill and they're like, oops, this fix needs to be made. So thank you. So anyway, that's where the bill is. It's not filed yet. We're hopeful it'll get filed within the next 2 weeks. We'll get it back from Ledge Council and get it a sponsor and get it on file. And then by the next board meeting, the filing deadline for bills is March 10th, and our next board meeting is March 9th. And I'm hopeful that way before then we'll have it filed and we can report to you where that is and seek a hearing and in the committee and get it on its way.
Does this bill address the situation?
I'm sorry?
That we've talked about, like, in this bill, I'm going to be mindful about how to use my words, about surviving spouses when a member gets killed in the line of duty. Is it? Yes, it does address it. Right.
That's the specific point, is to increase the benefit
for
the line of duty. Yes.
And it changes, and again, just, to rehash, just to review, and it is changing it from, like, half to a survivor level?
To 100%, yes.
Oh, to 100%?
Right.
Okay,
from 50% to 100%.
I thought it was going to be adjusted for as if the member that is, elected to have.
It's 100% J&S? No. It's actually 100%.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Hey, Kelly, I have a quick follow-up question. I have a quick follow-up question. Sorry, I'm not in the room. Will the filing and passage of this bill create, for the lack of a better term, division within our plan? So you'll have some people that this applies to and some people that won't be covered by the bill?
When you say some people will be covered, when people won't, I'm not sure what you mean by that, Armando.
So previously there was a resolution that covered up to a certain date. That resolution was rescinded, I believe, in 2018, where now we have a group from 2018 to when this bill gets passed that this bill would not go back and cover, correct?
Correct. It is not. It's only prospective. It's not. It is not retroactive. That's correct.
Do y'all foresee any type of way to address that situation with verbiage?
I don't think it's the verbiage issue. It was the board had a conversation considering the financial status of the plan and the impact on the plan and the likelihood of trying to do as modest of a change as possible to increase the chances of getting it passed through Austin was the conversation.
Refresh my memory. How many people since the resolution was rescinded in 2018 to this date, how many people does this, for the lack of a better term, gap impact? Do you remember that number?
So I don't have that number, but if you went retroactive, you would have to go back retroactive I would assume you wouldn't pick an arbitrary date. And the 2018 change, which it had different criteria in it, so there were some people, as Ms. Walter said, if you weren't eligible to retire, you weren't getting the 100% at that time. There were people that prior to that resolution being impacted that got 50% benefit that are still living. I mean, they might have been granted their benefit in, 1980, and they're still getting 50%. So we could look at that. I can give you the numbers about the number of people from 2018 forward. I would have that, not off the top of my head, but I can definitely get you that. But I think we would need to look at the universe.
The bill, the resolution was passed by the board, I believe, in 2008. So that's basically a 10-year period where people were getting the enhanced benefits. So to Kelly's point, like people who passed away prior to 2008, they were only getting the 50% benefit, and so they would. So then, you wouldn't. I don't think it's logical to say we're only going to go. We would only go from 2018 forward. We would go back to the beginning of when this benefit was being granted. I think that would only be fair. And so the cost seems like it would be a pretty, a lot of people and a large cost. And I think that was the whole discussion with the board of doing the right thing, but in the most, cost-effective manner to just, ensure that the highest chance of success is down in Austin to get the bill passed.
I believe that 2018 resolution, which I recall very much so because it was very difficult, and I don't even think I voted for it. It's that it was in that period before 2018 resolution, it granted full benefits to a spouse, a surviving spouse. And the decision was made that because they were not a member, they could not make that decision. And that's why it was reversed. Because it was all predicated on the fact that despite the event, but in this particular case, it was a loss in a line of duty that they were given 100%, and the way in which we reversed it, saying that they were not a member to delegate, to designate that. And if I recall, that's the way it was. And I was like,
so I'm not going to get into the legal thing, of course, because I'm not a lawyer and probably wouldn't want to. The reason that we reversed the resolution was for legal reasons, and we can talk about
right.
That.
Right. I remember that. I remember that.
Let's have a little longer discussion.
Okay.
So, I guess the I'm sorry. Are you there, Bill?
Go ahead now.
I guess the information that I need or I would like to have is how many people pre-2008 would this impact, and then how many people between 2018 to today would this impact, so we can make a good informed decision to see how this thing's truly going to move forward. So that's my ask at this point.
I will give you that information, Armando, but the other piece I'm going to give you is there is a group of people between 08 and 2018 that were not allowed to elect 100% JNS because they were not retirement eligible. So I'll give you that. I'm going to give you the whole universe sliced up.
Yeah.
So you can see the something that gives you the idea.
Peace on that, everyone. I think maybe we think about how you make that a presentation with the full board, probably.
So,
and again, I think it should be in the line of duty death. Because that really specifically saying to that.
So let me just make sure we're clear, because we will certainly provide this information to the board, but the bill filing deadline is March 10th. And so our intention is to have the bill filed, you know, as soon as possible, the way in the current form. I mean, we can go and you know, present the board, the information to the board, and, you know, potentially if the board wanted to seek an amendment to that bill, if you thought it was appropriate. But for now, our intention would be to file the bill sort of as it is, just on a prospective basis. The way
that's
written,
exactly
the way
what I'm asking for.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
And again,
yes, sir. Thank you.
Changing the economics for a member.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit more in a closed session about this thing.
Thank you.
One other question on legislation. Last legislature session, the controller came up with a list of investment firms that were not complying with or discriminating against oil and gas companies, et cetera. And I think he had some of the bigger funds were affected by having to look at potential divesting of investments with those firms. But does that apply to us at all?
No, that does not apply to us.
And we don't have any, well, BlackRock's the only one. We don't have BlackRock. But it's
none of that, yeah, that legislation does not apply to our system, yeah.
Okay. Good enough. Okay. Last thing, before we go to closed session, I've asked Kelly to give us the executive director's report now so that we can end the meeting with the closed session and then the supplemental meeting. So,
okay.
Kelly, do you want to do that?
You're on page 141 is your NCPRS monitor report. Since the last board meeting, we've had 3 open records requests, and I wanted to point out and congratulate Ken Haven because he has been appointed to the TexPRS Board of Directors.
Right.
So we will be well represented.
Very good.
And that's all I have.
On the 3 open records, is there any issues there? I mean, we're complying with them all?
Yes, and one of them took, was it 13 emails to send the documents? They'd asked for all of our financial statements going back to 2005.
Okay.
Okay.
Good enough. So we will go to closed session now.